Welcome back to In Search Of, a podcast where we go in search of voices and ideas that expand and enrich a life of faith. I'm your host, Amy Frickholm, and before we begin today, I want to tell you about a special opportunity for an adventure that I will be leading this summer. Along with pastor and writer Melissa Early, I will be leading a small retreat in the High Rockies called Discovering Your Spiritual Autobiography. We will be leading retreatants through exercises designed to reflect on various stages of our spiritual lives. We'll identify mentors and inspired moments, demarcate chapters, and even wonder about the future. It's a writing-intensive retreat, but participants will have time to gather as a community, get outdoors in gorgeous historic Leadville, Colorado, and find renewal in the mountain air. For more information, go to sagemountaininstitute.com. On the final episode of season 3, I want to try something a little different. I don't have a guest. Instead, I want to tell you the story of a woman who has become profoundly meaningful to me personally. As I mentioned in the opening to this season, I've had an on and off obsession with lost women. And sometimes I find a woman whose story speaks to me so profoundly that it begins to shape and change my life. This happened with Julian of Norwich, who seemed to come alongside me and speak to me at a critical moment in my life. It happened again with Mary of Egypt, whose story followed me around, haunting me for decades before I took a close look at it. And now it has happened a third time, with a woman whose name I came across in a random quotation on the internet, and it was followed by a sensation of quickening. Who's that? This woman is Maria Skoptsova. She's a saint in the Orthodox Church and a saint in my own life. I'm guessing that the vast majority of listeners to this podcast will never have heard of her, and I know I certainly hadn't until chance intervened. And I can't even remember what the quotation said on the internet that I read all those years ago. But since then, I've followed her around the globe. I've looked for traces of her in Turkey, the Republic of Georgia, France. And I'll tell you what I found. But first, let me tell you about her. She was born in 1891 to an aristocratic family in Riga, Latvia, and she died in the gas chamber of the Nazi concentration camp Ravensbrück on March 30, 1945. Her name at birth was Lizaveta Yurevna Pilenko, and her family owned an estate in Anapa, which is in the south of Russia, by the Black Sea. After the death of her father at the age of 14, she moved with her mother to St. Petersburg, and she became acquainted with the poets and writers who were working there at that time in what has been called Russia's Silver Age. There are poets like Anna Akhmatova and Maria Tsvetaeva. She was drawn to left-leaning politics and art, and she hung out at the renowned Stray Dog Cafe in St. Petersburg. There she developed friendships with Alexander Blok, a Russian symbolist poet who killed himself in 1921, and Boris Pasternak, with whom she continued to correspond all her life. She was 18 when she married a Bolshevik named Dmitry Kuzmin Karavayev, and their relationship was, I think it's fair to say, a disaster. Some of her biographers say that she married him out of pity because he was an alcoholic, he was adrift, and I can only imagine that he was a difficult person to be married to. But their marriage actually ended a few years later when, in the same year, Dmitry became a Roman Catholic priest and their daughter Guyana was born. At the same time, Elizaveta decided she wanted to study theology, and she applied for admission to the all-male St. Petersburg Theological Academy that met on the grounds of the Alexander Nevsky Monastery. The rector there decided to admit her. So she studied theology for some years, and she was in St. Petersburg in 1917 when Russia's provisional government was overthrown by the Bolsheviks. She was not then a Bolshevik. She belonged to a political party called the Social Democrats, which was also a left-leaning party. And at the All-Russian Soviet Congress, she heard Lenin's lieutenant, Leon Trotsky, dismiss people of her own party, and it became dangerous to be a Social Democrat. Rumors are that she, along with other Social Democrats, developed a plan to assassinate Trotsky. And when her friends dissuaded her, she returned to Anapa, to her family's estate, with her daughter. And a year later, she was elected deputy mayor there, which was clearly a bad move and a losing proposition, because on the one side you had the White Army, who were the aristocrats and members of her own family, and on the other side the Bolsheviks, and you had Elisaveta, who was not yet 30 years old. The White Army put her on trial for being a Bolshevik, but the judge in the case was a former teacher of hers. His name was Daniel Skoptsov, and the two of them fell in love. He acquitted her, they married, and in the chaos engulfing their society, they fled, like many others, when Elisaveta was pregnant with their second child. In the years after this, the family lived as refugees, following the route of many displaced Russians from Tbilisi, Georgia, where her second child Yuri was born, to Istanbul, Turkey, to Yugoslavia, where Elisaveta's third child, Anastasia, was born, and finally to Paris, where the family tried to survive amidst a tidal wave of desperate Russian emigres. The family did anything they could to survive. Elisaveta made and tried to sell dolls and silk scarves. Daniel tried to find work as a teacher. Meanwhile, Elisaveta still tried to write, still found herself drawn to theological movements, still found her spirit moving her towards serving the misery she saw around her. And then in 1926, Anastasia, 5 years old, died of meningitis. Everything started to fall apart then. Her marriage, her family, her entire life. Gayana was sent to boarding school in Belgium. Yuri moved in with Daniel. And Elisaveta took the first steps toward what would become the defining work of her life. She moved alone to central Paris to be close to those who were suffering the most. In the late 1920s and early 1930s, she began to develop the idea for houses of hospitality, which she said would be half monastic and half fraternal. She was encouraged by people like Sergei Bulgakov, a leading figure in the Russian student Christian movement that was an important movement in Paris at that time. And he suggested that she become a nun. In 1932, she took this step. She got an ecclesiastical divorce, took the name Maria, and started her, quote, monasticism in the world, unquote. She rented a house in central Paris and opened the door for refugees of any kind. She hosted salons there for theological and intellectual and artistic debate. Eventually, she took over a three-story derelict building nearby, and that's where she dug into her own pretty unorthodox version of what it meant to be an Orthodox nun in Paris in the 1930s. My own personal favorite story is about how she provided food for these houses. Early in the morning, she'd walk to the market and ask the marketeers for any produce that they were planning to get rid of. She developed a relationship with a Polish baker who provided bread for the house. And so she'd take these scraps and leftovers, turn them into lunch, and then serve them with bread and conversation at her house. This was an enormously creative period for her. The house was decorated with embroidery made using her favorite method, where she would just start anywhere and see what happened. She published poems, wrote essays, argued with the orthodoxy of her day, deepened her relationship with leading intellectuals, edited a journal, and spent many hours listening to the stories of the refugees who came her way. She opened new houses of hospitality at that time through an organization she called Orthodox Action. One of those houses was for families and one was for single men. She ran a sanatorium and a school, and by 1937, they were serving 120 meals a day out of the house on Rue de l'Ormel. But meanwhile, tragedy haunted her everywhere. Her daughter Guyana died after returning to Russia, and in 1940, France fell to the Nazis. The houses that Orthodox Action ran turned to helping Jewish and Russian refugees, both hounded by the Gestapo. One story goes that Maria Skoptsova helped organize sanitation workers to smuggle Jewish children out of the city in garbage cans. By now, Yuri was an adult and was working with her as well as her good friend, Father Dmitry Klepyanin. Klepyanin began to provide fake baptismal certificates to Jews. And in 1943, a letter about providing these certificates was found by the Gestapo in Yuri Skoptsov's pocket. He was arrested, and the next day, Father Dmitry was arrested, and the next day, February 10, 1943, Mother Maria was arrested. Dmitry and Yuri both died at the Dora concentration camp in Germany, both of illnesses contracted at the camp. Maria's story is a little different. Residents of Ravensbrück say that Maria Skoptsova continued to live just as she had done in Paris. helping where she could, using whatever resources she had. She held conversations about poetry and theology among residents, and some later described these conversations as life-saving. Then, on March 30, 1945, she switched places with another woman and sent herself to the gas chamber. So this is the story that has begun to work on me in many ways, both the life and the death of this remarkable person. Last summer, I went to 77 Rue de l'Ormel in Paris to see the place where Maria Skoptsova had lived and worked. And to be honest, there's almost nothing there. There's a lot there. It's a human place with lots of things going on, but there's very little of Maria Skoptsova there. It's just an ordinary place. The decrepit house that Skoptsova had turned into a hospitality center is now a 1960s era apartment building. There are balconies, there are pots of geraniums, businesses on the lower level. And there is a small plaque that notes that Skoptsova founded Orthodox Action in this place. But later, I went up to the north of France to a place called the Maria Skoptsova House, which houses refugees. And there she was, fully alive, active, doing her thing among the refugees of our day. And that made sense. Her spirit of spontaneity, encounter, and hospitality, her desire to live close to the edge of things, especially close to vulnerable people, and not to shield herself from what she found, that was all there. She wrote that her own theology was rooted in the second commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. She demonstrated with her whole life that this kind of love is, as she said, a very dangerous thing. We are wounded by this love. She often used the word pierced to try to describe it. Until we are, we can't really see the image of God in another person. As I consider the life of Maria Skoptsova, I've started organizing my thinking into four crucial actions that she took that I am interested in exploring in my own life. The first is feeding. The way that Maria Skoptsova fed people, it isn't just that she fed people, but the way she fed people was specific to her own circumstances. But I'm especially moved by the way that she used the scraps and remnants, the discards of her society for this work. And I think it shows an intentionally creative spirit of transformation. I can imagine her delight at discovering what any particular day revealed for her to work with. Material needs, she writes, have a spirit-bearing nature. And when we work with these needs, we are co-participants in the divine economy, she said. And this is where the second action comes in, the making and experimenting that was so much a part of her life. A spontaneous creativity was in everything that she did, from the curtains that she made, to the poetry she wrote, to the essays that have such insight into the society that she was critiquing. It was in the soup, it was in her painting, it was in every aspect of her life. She called life a messy, impossible art, and saw the possibility of art everywhere, from the experimental conversations that she hosted to the deep listening she did as people came to her with their struggles. But there's another aspect of Maria Skoptsova's life that I admit is a little harder for me. She organized. She organized other people. She created around her a society of action, not just individual acts, but a whole community of effort. She was never satisfied with individual effort. Even in Ravensbrück, she organized what one prisoner called real discussion circles. Jacqueline Perry said, together we would provide commentary on the texts and then meditate on them. And the last action, which is also probably for me the most primary, was welcoming. She was disturbed by forms of religion that wanted to hide themselves away. Almost above all else, she created doorways for people to walk through where they could be met as human beings. She wasn't interested in the religious forms of her moment. She was interested in how those forms make welcoming available to other people. She called this welcoming action non-possession, which she said should make a person open to the world and to people. She acutely observed the way that our religions themselves can become possessions, and we enact the opposite of true welcome. But Christ, she says, will go out into the streets, the prisons, the hospitals, the low haunts, and dives. Jesus says, whoever welcomes you welcomes me. And this puts both the welcomer and the welcomed into positions of receptivity, that Maria Skoptsova is teaching me is the foundation of the spiritual life. So that concludes this season of In Search Of. I hope you've enjoyed this exploration of some of the women who have shaped the Christian tradition and whose words, actions, and dreams have not infrequently been neglected, or, as we've seen, even stolen. We've been able to peer through the cracks a little and gone treasure hunting, which is, for me, the real joy of the search. So thank you for joining me. You can email us at insearchof@christiancentury.org. And also go to our website, christiancentury.org/insearchof, to connect with us. Also, please follow this podcast and rate it on your favorite podcast app. This helps other listeners find us. This has been a production of The Christian Century, a thoughtful, independent, progressive magazine for today.